My name is Mary Foltz. It's June 13, 2019. I'm here with Seth Travens as part of the Oral History Summer School Oral History Project. I'm going to talk to Seth a little bit today, and this interview will be included in the Oral History Summer School Archive. We are in Hudson, New York in Solaris, and I'm going to ask Seth to introduce himself.
My name is Seth Travens. I have been a resident and homeowner in Hudson for 5 years. I recently sold, my wife and I sold our house just last month. I'm a musician, and I've been a sauerkraut maker in Hudson and Columbia County in general. We have two children who were born right here in Hudson at Columbia Memorial Hospital. And I first came to Columbia County just to visit, I believe, in 1994, or at least to Hudson in 1994. I'd been in Red Rock many years before that, but that's kind of the other side of the county.
Well, to start today, I'm gonna ask you to talk about a person that matters to you.
Well, somebody who's played a large role in my life and who matters to me a lot is a man named Mark Schaffler, who is a Columbia County. He grew up in Columbia County. He owns Helsinki Hudson over on Columbia Street. And I had been a musician, and he had a club at Great Barrington, which was also called Helsinki. And he was one of those people that saw something in me and really helped me have a stage to perform on, to say the least. But he's sort of supported my music career ever since I met him. I should mention his wife, Deb McDowell, as well, or his partner, Deb McDowell, because she also has been a great supporter of my music. I am leaving the United States in a month or so. My family is moving to the Shetland Islands, but I would say that Mark and Deb are two important people who kind of, well, that I'm very sad to leave, but they definitely made me, allowed me to stay here and do my music. So, yeah, there are two people. I'm sure I could talk about more, but that's actually a, it's an interesting question that I hadn't pondered. Maybe we can come back to it if I remember someone else.
I'm wondering if you can describe how you met Mark and what that first meeting was like.
Well, Helsinki has always had an open mic, which is a night where amateurs can get on stage and perform songs or comedy or poems or some sort of thing that they want to share. And so I'd played the open mic at Helsinki in Great Barrington. And then I believe I didn't even know Mark or Deb. And I somehow booked a Monday night there, maybe through the sound technician. They didn't have many shows on Monday night, so it was easy to get a spot on a Monday night. And after having that show, which was a great success, I think Mark bought me dinner, and they were both very enthusiastic about what I was doing. So, yeah, that's how we met. Through the staff. The staff let me know that he was very appreciative of what I had done that one Monday night. But I don't actually remember shaking his hand for the first time or actually meeting him in person. It's more of, he was more of a mythical figure. I think I did observe him watching. Helsinki used to have, and they still do have great shows, but in Great Barrington, it was very easy to just wander in there any night of the week. And I thought that Mark was a dishwasher that was just watching the show, but he actually turned out to be the owner. think we should go on with the next question.
Can you describe the community of musicians in this area, in this region?
Yeah, my experience with the community of musicians has really been between Columbia County and Berkshire County, which is the next county over, but it's in Massachusetts. I'm 43, and there are a bunch of people my age who live more over in Berkshire County or on the border in Columbia County who were very into bluegrass music in the early aughts, probably around, well, even the late 90s. And so I got exposed to a few different musicians. Lucas Schwartz, who lives in Hillsdale, a guy named Kip Biacco, who lives in Great Barrington, Matt Downing lives in Great Barrington. Matt Downing and Kip Biacco now actually run a music festival in Hillsdale, New York, which is in Columbia County, called Old Tone. And they also have a music festival called Supertone, which happens at the Basilica. So those three gentlemen, and a woman named Mary Averton, who she owns a secondhand or a vintage clothing shop on Warren Street called Sideshow. So the four of them introduced me to a lot of music that I wasn't that familiar with. I was very versed in older blues and folk music, and even a bit of more popular country from the 1950s, but I didn't know all that much about bluegrass and old time even. So those four people introduced me to a lot of that music, and they were very passionate about it. So there was kind of that contingent. In Columbia County, I used to live at Hawthorne Valley, and there was a lot of music coming through there. I'd also gone to Bard College, so there was a bit of a jazz scene down at Bard, which would sometimes filter into Hudson, I would say. But the music scene around here, it's hard to talk about. I mean, there's definitely a draw towards Woodstock, and some people, because of the festival and because Woodstock has been an arts community for so many years, and I think some people have gotten sidetracked by coming to Columbia County. In Hudson alone, I mean, there have been some great musicians who've lived here. Michelle Nejocello, who's a bass player, she lived here for many years. And I think Ben Folds lives in Hudson now. But as far as a music scene, yeah, it's hard for me to think where it all starts. There is a festival called Falcon Ridge, which has been around for about 30 years, and I think that's attracted people. That's in Hillsdale, New York. So there's a little bit of, that's a place that people would go every summer. It was really popular, I think, until the early 2000s locally. It still has a big following, but I think at some point it was a very local festival. So I remember that being a huge highlight up till about 2004, 2005. I think we need to move on.
Tell me about how you became a musician.
I grew up playing the viola. I took viola lessons, and it's really not, I wouldn't recommend starting out on that instrument because you don't read music in the same clef as most instruments, neither the bass clef nor the treble clef. It's called the alto clef, and I think the viola really is the only instrument that uses that clef. Anyhow, so after a couple years of lessons, I got bored of the instrument, and I think the way that classical music is often taught doesn't have much context. It's just, you learn this piece first and then you move on. It's a very linear method of learning. I didn't find it very inspirational. And I heard the records of Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan and somewhat the Beatles as well. I mean, my parents came of age in the 60s, so those records were around, and the harmonica, just when I first discovered what the harmonica could do, I picked up a harmonica at about the age of 12 and moved on to guitar and a little piano. and eventually the upright bass, but I got into music through the harmonica. It just, there was something about it that was so visceral, that kind of like led me to delve into all different types of mostly American music, American folk music and blues. So that's how I got started. And I played throughout my teenage years, and I went to Bard College, and I didn't study music to major in it, but I took a few music classes and sang in the choir, and played informally a lot with other musicians. So I always wanted to be a musician. A lot of Bard graduates would move to a city and try to pursue their art, and that was never an interest of mine, particularly New York City, to live there. It just seemed like you have to work so hard just to pay for rent that it just never appealed to me. And I was always, even though I grew up in Queens, New York, I always thought of myself as more of a rural person. So I started working in Hawthorne Valley in 1998, which was a year after I graduated Bard. And so I kind of gave up on music as a career, but honestly, because I was up here and was able to connect with people over many years, eventually I was touring internationally through musicians I'd met up here. So that was really gratifying. And this is kind of jumping forward, but when I was at Hawthorne Valley, I created a job for myself making sauerkraut, and it was the type of work at that time where we would process a lot in the fall and then pack through the rest of the year. So I had a lot of flexibility in the summertime and the spring to be playing music. So in that way, that was really something. I mean, maybe I could have created something like that in a city, but I was just at the right place at the right time and was able to sort of do both careers at once.
So I'm really curious about creating this job to make mm-hmm. sauerkraut. I mean, yeah. This seems really exciting and interesting to me. Could you say a little bit more about how that came about, how you thought of this job, how you developed it?
Sure. Well, I became a farm apprentice at Hawthorne Valley Farm, and I was very naive in many ways. There was a fair amount of cabbage. I mean, it may have been as little as 100 pounds, but left over at the end of the season. And so the wheels in my brain started turning, because Hawthorne Valley processes milk into yogurt and cheese, and they grew a few acres of vegetables. And I thought, well, if they have a year-round market, what if they were able to process some kind of vegetable into something that they could sell year-round as well? And there was a man at Hawthorne Valley who ate sauerkraut for breakfast every day. And he was telling me about how, you know, he was eating this canned stuff, but there's some really good stuff from Vermont that is way better because it's not canned. And I'd never known the difference between raw and canned sauerkraut. So I made a test batch. I think it was the first year I was at Hawthorne Valley. It was the fall of 1998. It was all of a gallon of sauerkraut, but it was amazing. It turned out really well. And then the next year, I made 1,200 pounds of sauerkraut. And then, I mean, now Hawthorne Valley has a factory down the street in Hudson that makes, I don't know, 500,000 pounds of sauerkraut a year. So, I mean, 1998, it's 2019 now. So, I mean, in 20 years, this thing really took off. And I was there at the start. So it was a success in the beginning. We made 1,200 pounds of sauerkraut and sold it very quickly, and kind of moved on from there and diversified the line of flavors. And I had worked in other departments at Hawthorne Valley, but eventually it became not a full-time job, but a job that I was managing, but could also kind of manage to have a music career. And I think I was at the right place at the right time because fermented foods really started taking off. There weren't any really competing brands at that time. Most sauerkraut was just something you bought in the supermarket that was canned and what most people are familiar with. But in the last 20 years, there certainly has been a resurgence of live foods. It was a good balance to be able to work hard at one time a year and then also have a lot of free time at other times a year. After working on a farm, which you could work 80 hours a week if you wanted to, this seemed like a much better way of doing things, for me at least.
Can I ask a point of clarification?
Sure.
Where is that farm located? Is that within Columbia County? Is it outside?
Yeah, it is within Columbia County. It's probably from Hudson about 25 minutes. It's in the foothills of the Berkshires or the Taconic Mountains. So it's just east of here and maybe a little bit north. Yeah. It's technically in a hamlet called Harlemville, which is part of Hillsdale, but it has the mailing address of Ghent, so people get confused about where it is all the time. But New York State is like that, where we have town names and post offices, and, you know, Woodstock was 70 miles away from the town of Woodstock, and that's kind of how New York State is, I think.
So, can you describe to me what it was like to tour internationally?
I'm part of a group called the Wyos, and one of the musicians in the Wyos, his name is Teddy Weber. He moved to Berkshire County in probably, 2001, something like that. We met soon after he moved here. And then he ended up living in Columbia County for maybe 8 years after that, but he had joined a group called the Wyos, and they lost their bass player at some point. So I'm an upright bass player now. So I was sort of the first person the rest of the group called. And within a few months, I was on a plane to Glasgow, Scotland. And we played a festival in Glasgow called Celtic Connections, which, brings musicians from all over the world. And there were scouts from other festivals there, one of them being the Shetland Folk Festival. And I guess they just had some last minute funding and they'd seen us at this festival. And so then we got sent to Shetland that April. So this was maybe 3 months after we'd been in Glasgow. We came back, we probably toured in the States a bit, and then we're flown to the Shetland Islands, which is where I met my now wife. I guess, you know, if that hadn't happened, my life would be a lot different right now. But I guess when I say internationally, since I've been with the group, we've only toured in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, England, Canada. We might have a trip coming up to Siberia, so that would be truly international. But as far as touring in the UK goes, I mean, it's a pretty civilized place to tour. It's distances between towns are pretty short. You can pretty much walk anywhere in the United Kingdom, particularly in Scotland. They don't have no trespassing laws like they do here. Things are more accessible, but, I don't know. It's a real honor when you get to play music for people in anywhere, but particularly when you're far from home and you get treated well, it's a pretty nice thing.
Can you describe for me the dynamic of the Wyos as a group?
Sure. When I started with the group, there were four members. Teddy Weber, who I talked about, he was playing steel guitar with the group at that time, which is an instrument that you can either play on your lap or it has legs and you play it with a slide. And then there was another guitarist named Parrish who played, I wouldn't say a normal guitar, he played a resonator guitar, which is a very loud acoustic guitar with a metal resonator. And then Michael Farkas, who is the lead guy, he plays harmonica and kazoo and washboard. And actually, when I started touring with the Wyos, he never said anything on stage. He was mute except when he sang. So he would often have ways of communicating with the audience where he would have signs that said nonsensical things on them. He's a real performer and character. So I think, yeah, the Wyos have a dynamic of being a little bit of a comedy act on stage. And I think off stage, the three of us, Michael, who's the lead guy that plays harmonica and kazoo and washboard, Teddy and myself, we're kind of like a family. Like, we've got a great dynamic of traveling. We really know how to get along well. And we've been on the road for thousands and thousands of miles together. So we've gotten used to one another and kind of know each other's habits. And we always joke that sometimes we'll play a gig and be in the most sort of romantic place having dinner and wish that our wives were there, but it never really happens that way. The other joke is that we all notice each other when we have new clothes. And once again, with our wives, we never notice when they have new clothes. Somehow we're fashion conscious with each other. Strange tidbit, but I guess that's true. But yeah, I mean, once again, I mean, I've been blessed to work with two people like that. Because the world of music can be a dark place, I think. Touring and there's not necessarily people looking out for you, but in this group, we've always looked out for each other, so that's been really nice.
Can you talk about some of the music that you've made that matters to you, that has mattered to the group?
Well, we did an album back in 2012 that was a little bit of a left turn from the more traditional vaudevillian comedy kind of music that we'd done before. We recorded a concept album based on The Wizard of Oz in a modern day context called Twist. And I think a lot of it talks about the environment, maybe not directly, but indirectly, certainly. And it won an independent music concept album of the year award. But I think that work really was something we're proud of. And it kind of, we took what we knew from the traditional material and made a statement in an album. Now I forget exactly what the question was, but that album was a great example of something we're proud of and something that we probably had lingering, but it just took a few years to get to do it.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes when you're touring, you wish your wives were there, and you had discussed briefly that you had met your wife when you were traveling.
Yes. Yeah.
Could you describe how you met your wife?
It's a funny story. So the Shetland Folk Festival is, it takes place at the end of April or the beginning of May. And the way it started was we got a flight to Aberdeen, which is in near the Highlands of Shetland, or the Highlands of Scotland, not Shetland. And then we got on a ferry at, I think it's 6 p.m., and you're on the ferry all night. Our booking agent rented us a four-berth cabin, they call it, I believe. So there's two bunk beds essentially that are connected to the wall, and you can strap yourself in because it goes, because the ferry is going through the North Sea, which is definitely a, can be a rough ride. I don't think we really slept on the ferry that night because the minute we got on there, all the musicians who were going to the festival took out their instruments and it became an all-night jam session. And that kind of sparked the whole festival for us, except for when we were performing, pretty much was a jam session. So I think the first... I need to take another drink, sorry.
This is Mary Foltz, and I'm back with Seth Travens, and we're starting again.
So the ferry to Shetland, to just backtrack, is a very big boat. I think you can fit 50 cars and even a few tractor trailers. They call them lorries over there. That's on one level of the ferry. And then there's cabins on another level and a restaurant and bar on another level. And you can go up on the top of the deck. So it's a really large sea vessel, larger than anything I'd been on. So this jam session takes place, and maybe we caught an hour of sleep in the cabins. I get off the boat. I had a bass with me that the booking agent had gotten to the ferry, which was, I remember the bass was sitting in a cargo box, one of those containers. And then we had to bring it onto the ferry, and there was a place to stow luggage, and a stand-up bass is a pretty big instrument, but they had plenty of room for that. And then I think we got off the ferry, were met by host families, and being that the driver, and I meet my host parents, or I don't know if you'd call them parents, for somebody in their mid-30s, but host family, and I was sure that I was going to put this bass in their car. And I know how to put a bass in a car. There's a way if you're an upright bass player. But, of course, the steering wheel is on the other side. So I go to the wrong side of the car to put the bass in. And somehow some BBC documentary filmmaker saw me do this and thought, I want to get this guy on film. So he had me reenact what I'd just done. Anyhow, so... I believe that we got to know our host family. The other guys were with other families, and I stayed with a family and another musician named Caleb Clotter, who also has turned out to be a great friend of mine. He's in a group called the Foghorn String Band. Anyhow, the way that the Shetland Folk Festival goes is that as a musician, you get bused to a small village where they have a town hall where there's a stage, and you do sound check probably at about 3 o'clock, and there's four acts that play a concert. Then you have dinner at about 5, and I think the concert starts at maybe 7 or 7:30, and that's done by 11, 11:30 at night. And then they bus you back to the center of Lerwick, which is the main harbor town in Shetland. And so it's probably midnight by that point, and jam sessions are going on in the center of town. And I think it's an old school with there's a piano in every room, and maybe the bar closes at 2 a.m. there, and the building closes at 3 a.m. So there are jam sessions that go till 3 a.m. And then after the jam sessions, there are after parties. And being that you're in the North Sea, pretty far up, it gets dark at, I don't know, 11:30 at night, and then starts getting light at 1:30. So there's not really much darkness. So the party commences through the night. That's how it usually goes. And then you might get to bed by 5 in the morning and then get up again sometime in the early afternoon and do your next sound check and do it all over again. This happened for 4 nights, and I think on the last night I met Myrid, my wife, at one of these after parties at about 5 in the morning, and we had a breakfast sandwich together and then wrote letters to one another, and then re-met a year later. But yeah, the Shetland Folk Festival, it was a complete immersion in music, and we were these American musicians playing really old school jazz and blues and some country, and then you've got musicians from Ireland playing traditional Irish music, and there were Norwegians playing traditional Norwegian music. I think there was even a group from India, but it was kind of a real amalgamation, and a lot of us ended up playing together through the whole week, through the 4 days. That was quite an experience. I don't think I'll have anything like that again.
How did you come to build your family in Hudson? A breakfast sandwich leads
to... So a breakfast sandwich leads to writing letters and some emails, but I think we communicated through letter. And then the Wives went on tour a year later, and my wife and I met up. Well, she wasn't my wife then, Myrid. We started seeing each other on this tour, and she actually came to quite a few of the gigs via train, or even she just rode with us in our van. And she came and visited, and we had a long-distance relationship for a couple of years. And then when we decided to get married, and we went through all the paperwork of her coming over here, I was living in a three-season cabin in Hillsdale, which just didn't seem like the winter would be that manageable after getting married. So we lived on Washington Street, which is actually where Suzanne lives. We lived right next door to her, renting a room from our friend Zach. And the house behind him on the next street was for sale. And so, yeah, we ended up buying a house in Hudson. My wife didn't drive at that point. She didn't have her driver's license. So it just seemed like Hudson would be a good place to land because you can walk everywhere here. And she wanted to start a flower business, and Warren Street was a good place to do that. Warren Street's the main street in Hudson here that it's a mile of kind of an architectural survey of America. Well, how should I put that? It's a survey of American architectural history. It's a mile long, which is pretty unusual for a main street, and it's walkable. So we opened up a flower shop there in the spring of 2014. But Hudson seemed like a good place to land and to start a business. And after having lived in sort of a more rural setting, even for things like music, everything was just a walk away rather than a drive away. So, I don't know if that answers the question, how you get from a breakfast sandwich to a family, but hope it covers some of it.
This is Mary Foltz, and I'm back with Seth Travens. Could you describe the first year of married life in Hudson for me?
First year of married life in Hudson? It's a great place to be. There's a lot of restaurants here. There's a lot of places to walk. I think the walking part of Hudson is so unusual for America. The fact that you see a bunch, there are people on Monday morning with suitcases rolling down Warren Street, which is just, you don't really see that in other towns in this country. It's more common to see that in Europe. But we were able to, it was a lot of fun just to be able to discover the city. I'd known Hudson before, but it's a lot different when you actually sleep in Hudson and can get up and walk places. I became part of the farmers market. I'd started my own sauerkraut business, so we got to know a lot of people through selling sauerkraut at the farmers market. and I guess when the first year we were married, we did escape Hudson in the summertime because I still was renting my cabin in Hillsdale, which was a nice respite. I mean, that was kind of a shock, not so much to me, but to my wife, Myra, that it got so hot in Hudson. You leave Hudson in the summertime and it immediately sheds 10 degrees. Number one, we're close to the river. And number two, there's just so much pavement in Hudson compared to the surrounding hill towns that, yeah, it's kind of a heat center here. That was a really nice duality to be able to go to a cabin that was far from anything else, when it was so hot out. But then in the winter here, I mean, it was actually quite easy after having shoveled so much snow to live in Hudson. It was like a luxury because one didn't have to do all that much. And the first year we were here, it was legal to skate on Oakdale. They would actually flood. Oakdale's the local swimming pond that's spring fed. They would flood, the fire department would flood it so you could skate on it. It was really nice. But I guess because of insurance that was stopped. I actually wanted to segue into Oakdale because that was kind of an epicenter, especially once we had one child. Our second child is only 7 months old, so we haven't spent that much time with him. But with our daughter Larkin, Oakdale became an epicenter. And Oakdale is a spring-fed lake in Hudson that is cold in the summertime when you swim in it, at least under the surface. So it's an amazing oasis from this heat. There's a beach there with lifeguards. You don't have to pay anything to go there, which is kind of unheard of in New York State. It's city funded by the youth department in Hudson does this. And I guess Oakdale's been a public park in Hudson since the, I want to say 1940s. It was dug in 1915. But anyway, this became sort of a place that we really grew to love. And especially in having young children, we met other parents there. I was part of a group called Friends of Oakdale Lake that now has gotten the Columbia Land Conservancy involved in cleaning up the lake somewhat. It actually is very clean water, but the surrounding area, we've had annual trash cleanups, and we're looking to just improve the facility so that it's more welcoming to anyone. But it's pretty amazing because it's like a little, yeah, even though it's a man-made park, it's kind of essential to a city to have a place like that. And to be able to swim in a city is pretty cool, I think. So that at some point, yeah, in having young children, that definitely became a focus of ours. And we eventually met someone named Tamar Adler, who she's a writer, but she really got behind the project and has really moved it forward, that I think if I come back and visit in many years, it'll be a great place to see again.
Could you tell me what it was like to start businesses in Hudson? Because you had the two.
Yeah, so we had a business called Flower Kraut, which my wife started. That was the flower shop. We ended up doing a lot of weddings. But the kraut part of it, I started my own sauerkraut company. After being at Hawthorne Valley for many years, I left to essentially become a touring musician. And then I started my own sauerkraut company back here in Hudson. And so we called it Flower Kraut, which was, and it's still there. We sold this business back in January. But I think having a name that's catchy is a great thing for a business. In fact, some people would get, you could hear them through the glass when they'd walk by. They'd be really mad. Flowers and sauerkraut. It just, So it definitely perked people's ears up, I believe. And I mean, Flowerkraut still does a pretty good business in sauerkraut. But yeah, a business in Hudson, there's an amazing influx of people coming into this town for better or for worse. Flowerkraut somewhat catered to a lot of the tourists that came in, but I think we had a lot of local customers as well. I think it is a good place to have a business because it's the county seat. I think not everybody in Columbia County comes to Hudson, although you have to come here for, say, to get your driver's license, or if you buy a car, or all the banks are in Hudson. I mean, there are banks in other towns as well, but most of the lawyers have law offices here, like all the real estate lawyers and whatnot. So Hudson definitely is still a place that local Columbia County people come to. And Warren Street is kind of the most popular street probably in the county, I would say, that probably sees more foot traffic and car traffic than any other street here. So that was kind of a natural place to get a business. And initially, with my wife's business plan, it was affordable. She was able to definitely make rent and do pretty well in that space. And create a job for Amanda Bruns, who bought the business now, basically has a job doing that. And so that feels really good that we brought a business to town and it's still going and it's supporting someone. So it was a risky thing to do, and it took a lot of probably more creative and time investment than actual monetary investment. But it was amazing watching my wife, who'd never run a business before, just become a master of it. She got really into the bookkeeping end of things, and she always says she's not good with numbers, but she's actually... Or she's not good with math, but she's very good with numbers. So it was really exciting. I mean, it was a real success, I would say. The amount of publicity we got, I mean, it was in many ways more, it felt more real to me than the music career I've had. Maybe because we had a brick and mortar store. And you saw people's faces and you made connections with them that weren't as transient maybe as being a musician. Being a musician, you might make a great connection with someone who becomes a fan and you see them once, or you don't even actually get to meet them, but you make an impression on someone. Having a storefront, I think that impression goes both ways. So that was pretty enlightening. And my wife will be probably opening a retail store when we get to Shetland, because I think she's really discovered that that's kind of her calling in many ways. I think having a business in Hudson, it's a great thing socially, because there are a great number of businesses in Hudson. Many of them are women-owned, and that's unusual. So Myrd found a great community of people who were not in the same boat, but doing a similar thing to her. So socially, I feel that was a huge step in Hudson for us. I think at first when we got here, it's a little harder to make a name for yourself if you don't work in the town. But if you have something to show for what you do, I think that's how one gains respect. My wife has mentioned, or we talk about how Hudson's definitely part of, it's in New York, but it kind of feels like it's part of New England a little bit. The people who have moved here can be a little standoffish. I feel like Hudson's the kind of town where sometimes you might say hello to someone 17 times before you actually get to know what their name is. In a place like Shetland, where there's only 20,000 people and it's on an island far away from anywhere else, that's not the case. People are a little more forthcoming and really want to know who you are, because newcomers are an unusual thing, whereas Hudson has become a place of newcomers. I mean, it's always been a transient place with the railroad and industries going in and out, but in the last 20 years, I think it also has been a place where there's always an influx of people. There's always a changeover of businesses on Warren Street. It's a constantly changing place. So I think in having the businesses, it kind of doesn't give you a personality, but it gave us a bit of standing in the community.
You said earlier, for better or worse, people are coming into Hudson. Could you explore that a little bit more?
Sure. Hudson is an unusual place in that when I first came to Hudson, that was about 1994, I went to Bard College. You could rent an apartment in Hudson for about $200. And now I think you can probably rent an apartment, if you're lucky, for $1,200. And that's 25 years. So there's been some inflation, but not that much inflation. Buildings on Warren Street have gone from selling for tens of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars. So a lot of money has come in and preserved the architectural history that we have here, which is great. On the other hand, for it to be an affordable place for quote-unquote middle-class people to live, I think it's becoming harder and harder. And then, of course, there are those who have been in Hudson for many years who are poorer and don't own their own homes, and they're just getting pushed further and further away. There was a gentleman who worked at the sauerkraut plant in Hudson that I got to know, and he'd lived in Hudson all his life, but because the rents, and he was a great worker, his name's Sean, because the rents were going up so much, he had to get a car for the first time in his life. And he was sad because he had to get an apartment elsewhere. I mean, it wasn't very far away, but here was someone who'd known walking all his life, which is just, it's just a different perspective, you know, and I think Hudson has become more of a town for tourism, and many apartments that used to be rental apartments have now turned into short-term rentals. So that's a real issue. I mean, even in the house we lived in, I would say that probably just looking at just around our house, two of the four houses were rentals, short-term rentals, not long-term rentals. So from a homeowner's perspective, it kind of feels like a ghost town a little bit, because you don't know who are in those houses, and sometimes they're empty and sometimes lights are left on, and it feels a little bit like it's not living so much. So that's something that in the 5 years we've been here, we've seen more and more of, just more money coming in, which, as I said, can actually help a city, but it can drive people out. And also, when you have homes that are empty for half the year, that really feels unfortunate.
What's it been like to raise children in Hudson?
I've found it to be great. The new library has opened up recently, which was about three blocks away from us, so we could just walk to the library. So anytime it was raining out or one needed to get out of the house, the children's section there is really nice. It's a nice space for children. And often on a weekend, there were just activities going on the whole time. So that's been a great asset. My daughter's 3.5, so for that, from the age of even 1.5 on, I mean, that's been a great thing to be able to go to the library. That is, there are a lot of parks in town, which is great. I have found, though, that they're very underpopulated. I think that children in this, there aren't that many children in Hudson, I think, Hudson proper. And I don't know, playgrounds just don't seem to be populated in Hudson like they did when I was younger. There's a playground in Greenport, which is 2 miles away, and that seems to have lots of people, but you have to drive there. You don't have to drive there, actually. There is a trail that goes all the way from the high school. The Columbia Land Conservancy has a trail that you can access from Hudson all the way to that park and even north of there. But sometimes it felt like a ghost town for children. We always found something to do. I do feel like, even though we could walk everywhere, we didn't run into people in terms of people with kids as often as I would have expected. But I do really think that being able to walk anywhere is such a gift. We're such a car culture, and I can just see every time you have to get a child into a car seat, there's just such a process about it that kind of takes the fun away from spontaneity sometimes. That's what I'll miss about Hudson the most, is not having to rely on my car very much.
May I ask about changes in the landscape or the environment since you've lived in this region?
Sure. So I came to Columbia County in 1998, and I had gone to Bard College in Dutchess County, which is much different. Columbia County, when I got here, there were a lot of dairy farms, which went out within a few years of my getting here. One of the reasons for that is that the milk price for conventional farmers who sell to even something like Cabot Cheese, that also, I think Agrimark is the name of the cooperative that buys milk around here, they supply Stewart shops with milk. The price of milk really hasn't changed since the 1970s. So to make it as a dairy farmer is really, really difficult unless you process your own milk and into cheese or yogurt. And even when you do that, it's really hard work, and economically it is very hard to do. It's much different than it was probably in the early 70s, I think. The price of milk that the farmer got compared to what a living wage was much better back then. So dairy farms went out. I mean, some great things I've seen about the landscape in Columbia County is that a lot more nature preserves and parks have opened up in the last 20 years. There's been some development, but not that much to change the feeling of the county too much. I kind of fear that in 20 years it might really be very congested and developed in a way that's not thought out in a great way, in my opinion. This is definitely my opinion. Other people might have other opinions, but from when I've been here, there hasn't been that much change, I would say. More housing, but I think the housing market up here is much more, there's just a turnover of houses. I don't think there's been that much more development. One thing I must say, though, is that one of our favorite swimming spots that I've been going to ever since I got here, it's right off the Taconic Parkway, but there was a dead-end road in Hillsdale that you could then walk through the woods, perfectly legal to do, and you'd get to this pothole on the Agawamic Creek where you could jump off a cliff into like an 8-foot pool of spring water. It was amazing. some investor bought the road, the dead end road, and put a fence up. And I mean, that breaks my heart that state land, even though it's on state land, access to state land can be privatized. So there's a few examples that I can think like that even though the landscape hasn't changed, that makes a huge change when someone puts a fence up and buys a dirt road. So that's one real change that I've seen.
Well, we're nearing the end of our time, so I have two more questions, if I may.
Sure, yeah.
One, you said the thing, you talked about what you'll miss about HUD since you are moving.
Yeah.
I just wanted to open, what else might you miss about Hudson since you'll be leaving the country and the region?
Well, I think I've been involved in agriculture here, and I take for granted that you can go to a Saturday farmer's market and buy any number of farm products that were grown within 20 miles of here, if not five. That certainly I will miss. And where agriculture, even though we've lost farmland in Columbia County in the last 20 years, the amount of access to local produce and more sustainable, I might say, or organic, or land not using pesticides has increased. So small farms have increased in this county and large farms have decreased. But in terms of access to buying what comes from the land here, there's a cornucopia of products you can get. So I'll definitely miss that. I think I'll also miss the fact that there are still lots of bodies of water to swim in here. There's amazing trees and different pockets in the county. You get a lot of different landscapes, from mountainous. Alander Mountain is right on the easternmost part of Columbia County, to the Hudson River. I mean, what's in between all of that? There's just so many different little micro landscapes. I'll be moving to a place which is pretty much sea, beaches, and peat fields and pastures. Not any trees. There are no trees in Shetland. I mean, there's a few planted trees, but as far as compared to Columbia County, it's nothing. So I'll definitely miss trees and the diversity of the landscape here. And the diversity of the seasons. We can have really hot summers, we can have really cold winters, and then we can have beautiful weather in between. I mean, I like that diversity of temperatures and snowfall and rain. And yeah, so that, it's a great place to live in terms of that. You really get to see a landscape that is completely different in every season.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share today?
I guess when you come back to the question of who's important to me here in this town or this county, I guess I think back to a lot of the older farmers I've met, landowners. There have been just a whole cast of characters that I've known over the years here that have passed on or are quite old now. And remember what it was like years ago when there was just a lot less going on here. There was a poet named Peter Defoe who lived in Harlemville, who lived here since the early 60s. he was a friend of mine. I know all of his grandkids pretty well. his writing about the landscape around here is really wonderful. And where he lived and his wife still lives is just a magical little pocket in Columbia County. But yeah, I mean, there are so many people that I could mention that it's hard to, when you ask that question about who's important to me. I mean, there are so many people here who have been really supportive to me and inspirational. Both people who've moved here consciously or who grew up here, who were born here. There's definitely a certain community that you might not feel it in one moment, but in the 20 years I've been here, the people I've known and the experiences I've had are kind of, yeah, they're, it's just been a real education.
Do you want to share some more about the, you talk about the poet Defoe?
Peter Defoe, yeah.
Do you want to talk about some others at the conclusion of the interview that you'd just like to share here, people that have been important to you?
Well, my parents are renting a place in Livingston right now, and it was owned by a man named Bob Stickles. The Stickles family, you see their name on roads. There's a Stickles cement pouring company that does most of the foundations in Columbia County. But he owned a place called the Happy Clown Ice Cream. That was one of his careers. He raised peacocks. He had this farm. He passed away last year. But he was really good friends with a farmer named George Atkinson, who passed away recently, who used to be the guy who'd come to Hawthorne Valley to pick up animals that were going to the slaughterhouse. But George Atkinson was like the most gentle man with cows. Turns out my parents rent a place from one of his best friends. I guess in the 20 years I've been here, I've just seen some connections between some of these people. I rented my first sauerkraut kitchen or processing space when I started my own business. Was owned by Abby Rockefeller, who's one of the Rockefeller families, but she owns many acres in Livingston. And, you know, she had connections to some of these farmers. The web of connections up here. I mean, I guess you could say that about any community, but it's the only one that I've really known such an intricate web of people. I don't know who else I could talk about. There was another guy named Harry Laser who passed away. He did a lot of artwork. He owned a bookstore. His daughter actually ended up renovating this house that was almost a teardown, and she and her husband turned it into a beautiful house again in Hudson. They ended up moving around the corner from us, but Harry was, he was one of the wise old men of the farm stores, along with Frank Serpico, who's a kind of legendary New York City policeman. They were kind of best friends, and they would always be in there just, you know, chewing the fat. So, those two guys were always great to talk to. Yeah, it's hard to think of specific people.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to share some stories with us. So thank you a lot.
Thanks very much, Mary.
This is Mary Foltz. I'm back with Seth Travens, and he is going to play us a little music.
Yeah, I'll say a little introduction about it. This is a song that's not all truth, but it spurned on from a man who still lives in Columbia County named Lee Coulter, who I believe first started working on a horse farm in this county, and he's done all kinds of jobs. He's been a stonemason, a produce seller. He's a singer as well. He's got about 6 children, I think. And he works for New Leaf Tree Services now. They're in Chatham. But he went by the stage name Robbie Lee Tucker. His name, his real name's Lee Coulter. And he, a group of friends and I used to have brunches on Sunday morning, kind of potlucks. And he came in one day and said, "Yep, I just got car number 17. And that kind of inspired me to write this song. It's called 17 Cars in 18 Years. I had 17 cars in 18 years. That's a lot more than a rig has gears. A lot more wheels than an 18-wheeler. A lot of steel made by Pittsburgh Steel. Toyotas, Hondas, and even Saab. I drove an Eldorado when I was in the mob. And for all that time, imagine that. Had one cowboy hat, classy license, was a driving truck. I owned a Yugo like a sitting duck. Me and the cars, it's all been bad luck. My last one, it only cost me a buck. Robbie Lee Tucker, that's my name. Four on the floor, that's my game. And if I had my way, of course, well, I wouldn't be driving. I'd be riding a horse back in 97. Had a good engine ready. I thought that it just sounded like heaven. My good gal, she wore out the clutch. We went to the mechanic, but we weren't going Dutch. Use car salesman, keep your line. Keep your chunk change, don't take mine. It's all going to my mechanic. This whole car business has made me frown. Had 17 cars in 18 years. That's a lot more than a rig has gears. A lot more wheels than an 18-wheeler. A lot of steel made by a Pittsburgh Steel. Robbie Lee Tucker, that's my name. Four on the floor, that's my game. And if I had my way, of course, well, I'd be driving, I'd be riding a horse.
Amazing. Can you tell me a little bit more about him, Robbie?
Yeah, Lee Coulter. He worked at the Hawthorne Valley Farm Store when I first met him. And I guess we played in a band together for a little while. But he can ride horses. He's one of these guys that can just get into a trade or a line of work and run with it. He's like very, very multi-talented. I don't think he was a stonemason when I met him. He's probably a few years older than me. He's probably maybe even 50 now. But he's one of these people that has just had multiple careers and seems to pick up and do something new. It's pretty inspirational. But he's a very, very talented stonemason. And now I don't know if he's doing tree work or if he's doing stone work for New Leaf Tree Services. I imagine he's doing some sort of landscape part of their business. He ended up marrying someone who worked at the farm store. And they have, I think they have six children between the two of them. So Lee Coulter, yeah, he's an inspiration for sure.
Is there anything else you want to play?
I don't know if I've got anything else that's pertinent to... I had this song I wrote about all the cows at Hawthorne Valley, but I can't remember all the words. It was all their names. And of course, the names change as the years go on, so... Yeah, I don't think... I think that song probably is the one.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.